Hello, and welcome to the How Epidemics End project, which is based at the University of Oxford. My name is Erica Charters, and in these videos, I'm discussing with experts how they research disease in a variety of ways, as well as their investigations into how epidemics end. Today, I'm here with two professors who together work on biological anthropology in order to understand disease and health. I have Clark Larson, who's professor at The Ohio State University, and Fabian Crespo, who's associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Louisville. So Clark and Fabian, many people will know that biologists study health and disease, and anthropologists and archaeologists study the past by looking at material remains, very often human skeletons. So can you explain a little bit more about how biology and archaeology work together? What do you use as evidence in your research?
Yeah, so the biology and archaeology together, it's really a subfield of anthropology. Our field is biological anthropology, and my specialty within that field is called bioarchaeology, which is the study of human remains from archaeological settings. So that's a simple definition. The larger definition involves the context for living conditions, including health and disease. And so we study what people ate, their population size, the kinds of communities that they lived in, size and density of the communities, and all sorts of evidence to play into the development of disease, including infectious disease. So our field, within this larger context of bioarchaeology, is very interested in origins of disease, impacts on health, with regard to epidemics and pandemics, how long do they last, what are the factors behind the history of those diseases as they hit a population, and how do they appear and do they disappear, do they end? And so the complexity of our field is to understand all those circumstances that play into health and disease and well-being.
It's really interesting to think about the different types of evidence that you use. So I'm wondering, can you explain a little bit more about what you look at when you're trying to examine disease in the past? What do you look at with human skeletons in order to understand health and well-being?
Yeah, so what we look at in human skeletons, and again, human skeletons are a reservoir of life experiences. And one of these, of course, is disease. So, of course, there are many kinds of diseases. Even tooth decay is a disease, dental caries, caused by a pathogen and interacting with the flora and fauna of the mouth and interacting with the foods we eat. But other infectious diseases that have impacted humans over the millennia include smallpox, which has very little evidence in terms of the skeleton. But other diseases pertain to pandemics and epidemics that took place, for example, in Europe in the Middle Ages. And unfortunately, there is very little physical evidence for some of these pandemics, some of these epidemics. But what we look at is we can look at the origins of the pathogen by looking at the microorganisms and the record of ancient DNA to determine where and when these diseases occurred. So we're very interested in the full picture of health and disease in terms of what we can learn from human remains.
One way I know that you've talked about this is thinking about the biosocial context of disease. So I was wondering if one of you can explain exactly what this means.
Fabian, why don't you take over here?
First, thank you, Erica, for having us and giving us the chance. For me, it's a great honor, as you can imagine, working with Professor Larson and also working with all colleagues here in this multidisciplinary project. My background is human immunology. I must clarify that as a biologist. But then many years ago, I decided to study immunology and especially inflammation in the past. And the only evidence that we can have is skeletal evidence. Of course, the immune system is gone, but it was having some kind of, as Professor Larsen was saying, skeletal samples, they do represent this kind of reservoir, not exactly the reservoir for the pathogen, but the reservoir for the whole life experience. So for me, it's trying to combine different markers in different skeletal kind of bones or the skeletal samples to reconstruct inflammation. And of course, to put that in context. So the biosocial component for me is, as I explained more than once, is I don't work only with immunity. I try to embrace a more kind of comprehensive concept that is immune competence. I know that sounds similar, but for me, the immune competence is allowing me to explain that not only the genetic information, the biological information will be useful for us to mount a proper immune response, but also environmental and social factors. As Professor Larsen was explaining, bioarchaeologists reconstructing lifestyles, diet, other diseases, comorbidities. So we can't put the immunity and immune competence in isolation of the rest. As we are facing nowadays with COVID-19, why we have differential mortality, why more cases here and less cases there, probably it's not only because of the biology of the host pathogen interaction, but also something else ongoing there.
Can you explain a little bit about one of the diseases that you've worked on already? I know you've worked on a range of diseases, but leprosy especially, I think, is one that people probably associate with the Middle Ages in Europe. There's still a few cases today, but how does this approach, how does your methodology, how do you study leprosy as an example?
Well, leprosy, well, few diseases, as Professor Larsen was saying, they are leaving some kind of, how do you say, osteological kind of signatures. If you want to choose, it will be either leprosy, tuberculosis, and syphilis, but they are just very fragmentary and controversial, but yes.
Just to add to that, the leprosy has a highly distinctive visible pathology in the skeleton. And so it's I wouldn't say it's unique, but it's pretty close to it. The fingers and toes and atrophy, the face, the facial skeleton and atrophy. And so there's a distinctive, and like some infectious diseases, a distinctive morphology of the impact of the disease. So for the history of the study of the disease, that was the primary interest. Now we're interested in more what Fabian is talking about in terms of immunocompetence, health of the individual, and the circumstances that arise with that disease. So Fabian, I just wanted to throw that in there.
No, but basically we chose, and also other historians, as you have here, Monica Green, Laurie Jones, and Nuket Valik, but pushing me to work on leprosy in some way, because leprosy, as many of you know, the clinical outcome of the disease also has something to do with the immune competence of the host. And you have a huge spectrum of different clinical manifestations, as you can study today. So we can try, if we can do the same in the past, if we can do two different things. One is to reconstruct as much as possible the inflammatory or the immune competence of the host, using all these different osteological markers, lesions that we can use for inflammation, chronic inflammation. On the top of that, as Professor Larsen was saying, can we use other skeletal markers, reconstruct lifestyle, make sense, diet, other comorbidities? And then on the other side is, can we see some kind of life history connected with leprosy? Can you see, well, mostly lepromatous leprosy, as most of the bioarchaeologists probably paying attention to this kind of interview will recognize, that most of the lesions are associated with one specific side of the spectrum. But clearly the ending of this kind of endemic leprosy in medieval Europe, as you know all very well, has something to do with probably the immune competence of the host changing. And not only because biological factors were playing a role, perhaps the pathogen, but perhaps also the immune competence of the host was changing. Many different factors, this biosocial, and perhaps moving into this syndemic idea. For us, the syndemic theory that we are using today, many scholars, is very powerful for us to explain this biosocial context in the past.
So Fabian, I'm just gonna add, that's a very important term here in the discussion, is syndemic. And you might explain what a syndemic is and how is that different from epidemic. I think that the viewers will want to know more about that.
That would be great, because I think it's true. Most people won't have heard of the syndemic theory.
Well, to start, I must be honest, I must clarify, syndemic theory was very well developed by many different scholars. Merrill Zinger is one of the top ones. So basically, at the beginning was, allow me to say, a more biomedical term, trying to understand the interaction of two different infection diseases happening at the same time in a single host. And the idea of syndemics, if you can just separate, will be synergistic epidemics. And then you remove some letters and you will get syndemics. So at the beginning was the interaction of, for example, HIV and tuberculosis. I'm talking about now contemporary kind of infection diseases. The same case with hepatitis C and HIV. But not, it didn't take too long for other scholars, especially I would say medical anthropologists, to start adding other factors in the equation. So this synergism, making things worse, makes sense, to accelerate or exacerbate, wasn't only the interaction of two pathogens, was the interaction of two infection diseases plus, for example, malnutrition, stress, lifestyles, other comorbidities. So the question, as you can imagine, is getting longer to understand the outcome. As you can explain nowadays, that the outcome of COVID-19 probably will have different clinical manifestations, social, political. So you have all these different layers. Merrill Zinger put it very clearly that in some ways trying to create a more social scientific approach to reframe and rethink public health. So basically the idea that we are doing is basically taking this complex theory into the past. Can we also explore the interaction, for example, leprosy and tuberculosis in the past, or perhaps leprosy and plague, but not ending there, you understand that. We need to explain and explore other factors playing. Probably it will be an oversimplification to think that medieval leprosy was more or less the same in the whole Europe. That would be just, all historians will be jumping at me and saying, no, do not create a homogeneous, makes sense, European history. The same case with this, the same country. Syndemics is open, makes sense, our picture to this, adding different factors that perhaps at the same time, they are totally different in different places. Now with the COVID-19 that we're talking about, I don't know if you saw in the news, that we should be calling pandemic, no, we should be calling a syndemic. But perhaps it's not a single syndemic, you understand? It's perhaps we have multiple syndemics depending on the continent, the region that we are facing. I think that syndemic is very powerful, keeping us this open mind.
The only issue with it is we understand what syndemic is, but I think that it's a term unfamiliar to your average citizen, to average person. What is that? What's the difference between epidemic and syndemic? And I think it's the overall understanding that those epidemics, pandemics, have a number of influences and a number of different sort of histories, as you were saying, that allow us to get into the deeper meaning of health and disease in the past and the present. It's complex, but we're attempting to sort out that complexity.
And my sense is also, as you're saying, that we need to have multiple perspectives and multiple insights. So as an example of different disciplinary work, having a biologist and having an archaeologist and anthropology all together, I think is one way of doing this. But my other sense is you're saying that we need to have a long-term perspective as well. One of the things I'd love if one of you can just maybe explain and conclude by explaining what this means for how we should think about epidemics ending. So did leprosy end with the decline of the disease? How should we take your findings of thinking about syndemic theories, about multiple disease, about biosocial context and immune competency? How does that change our understanding of the ending of an epidemic?
I think that, and I would like that also at the end, Professor Larsen will make a comment about if we think that there is an ending of epidemics or pandemics, but from a multidisciplinary perspective, if I would do this research from a multidisciplinary perspective, it will be a great mistake if I would think that I would have a single ending. Probably each discipline will bring or will find different endings. Epidemiologists will be just analyzing cases, makes sense, and the prevalence. But perhaps historians, economists, other kind of sociologists, psychologists, they will find different endings. And that's the kind of complexity of syndemics. For us to understand how the epidemic was happening, makes sense, it has the same complexity, how the epidemic will end. It will be, in my understanding, perhaps I'm misunderstanding syndemics, if syndemics will help us to reconstruct, makes sense, and understand the whole epidemic or pandemic, is equally complex to understand the ending. And the ending shouldn't be happening in a single day, makes sense, in a single moment or in a snapshot. Probably we're facing that. I don't know how this COVID will be ending, but it will be ending in a long time. It says it's not a single month maybe we're counting cases, but that's the case.
Just to add to that, that part of the perspective on never ending is that the whole global perspective on population health, population size, we're now at 8 billion and mounting. And so those epidemics and pandemics, part of their continuation is supported by that population increase. The world health context, for example, most of diet for the majority of the world population is based on the superfoods, rice and corn, wheat, which are carbohydrates, which is supporting the world population. And so that in itself, in terms of understanding disease and epidemics, is an issue just in terms of quality of life globally going forward. So one reason why epidemics, pandemics have a very fuzzy ending, if at all, is owing to these conditions, it will continue to mount and grow as they did in the past. Population was increasing and concentrating. And so that past record is so important for understanding and laying the groundwork for what's happening today. And I think that's another message of what we do in this field, is that what we are today, contrary to what most of the public thinks, is not new. The groundwork for it was laid with the transition from foraging to farming and living in permanent communities. And so it's that longer term context that helps us understand what's happening today.
Thank you both very much, Clark and Fabian, for reminding us of this long-term context and also for sharing your expertise with us. And thank you all also for watching our videos and the project. Please do fill out a feedback form. If you're watching on YouTube, you'll find the feedback form just below the video description. If you're watching on the project website, you'll find the feedback form just to the right. It only takes a few seconds and it helps to inform research at the University of Oxford. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.